If I can talk to you basically about the parts of man and the anatomy of the problem which we face when we face the processing of a person. And when we talk about this, we are talking about those processes which occur in level one as being the most factual processes where most cases are concerned. It's a very interesting thing that you must enter a case at its reality, not at yours. It's one of the first things that an auditor has to learn. He learns this the hard way. He sees a fellow come in. The fellow says, "Well, I don't seem to be able to talk without lots of pauses, you know, and so forth." And you talk to him for a few minutes, and he said, "Who used to talk like that?" Something like this, an old Dianetic auditor straight wire question. Sometimes solves him in a hurry. And, my father always talked like that, and he always talked with a lot of hesitation and so forth. But I'm real worried about my talking with a lot of hesitation. You get him around, get him the idea that he might possibly be talking like his father, you know. And you could go on like this for hours, and nothing would happen with your bricklayer. Because you're auditing him at your level of reality. You look at him, you know Dianetic and Scientology, you know exactly what he is doing. He's doing it superbly well. He is occupying a winning valence. He is in his father's valence. His father's universe and his universe are collapsed. There are undoubtedly overt acts against his father right there. And yet, at no space here does the preclear react. Well, that, remember, is you auditing him at your reality of the subject, and he is running at his reality level. After you've run him for a long, long while, many, many, many hours, and on processes which are real to him, why, he will come along, days and days, maybe weeks after you first fell into this, and he'll say, "You know, this slow speech, you know, I think that has something to do with my father." Now, if you can't cognite on the preclear's case before the preclear does, you're no auditor. But don't butcher that fact by cogniting and then trying to force the cognition into the reality of the preclear. This is evaluation, and is essentially the definition of evaluation. It is trying to enforce upon the preclear the reality of the auditor. And that's not the preclear's reality. Thus, we get a great deal of study along level one. Level one is subject to change. It's subject to change because Scientology is subject to cases. Scientology does not have that glorious freedom with which Freud worked. It does not have that abandoned typewriter with which the publicity boys working for the AMA and the APA and the BMA and the BPA or whatever it is work. "Great wonder drug frees all patients in all sanitariums last Tuesday." See, it has some concourse and friendliness with the truth, Scientology does. And as a result, it loses, to some degree, its freedom. It must accept the reality of the people it is addressed to in terms of processing. During the last 3 months, the psychometric testing in Washington, D.C., and here, both very, very fine testing divisions, have been overworked by the fact that something interesting had happened. We had missed, in some fashion, some step in Scientology that was making gain prior to 3 months ago. And somehow or another, all auditors, more or less simultaneously, stopped doing one thing or two things. What were these things? And it was discovered that they were doing a very interesting thing. Old six basic processes had remedy of havingness clear up at the top. And usually in training, auditors were not given this as a stress. And so they would not pay too much attention to it. And they would not recognize the truth of that old dodge, when in doubt, remedy havingness. Said that many times, but it had just gotten swept right out of the ken of Scientology, and it stayed swept out for 3 months. There were two or three things that came along that seemed to convince people that the best possible thing to do would be to just run a process and not pay any attention to happiness. I myself, in some of my lectures, undoubtedly made statements which tended to devaluate the remedy of havingness. And we were running separateness processes, and it's quite true that a very, very adroit auditor working very, very well can run separateness without remedying havingness. But at any time that he finds the pre-clear bucking and straining at the process, any time he finds him chewing up resulting energy masses, he had better remedy havingness at once. He'd certainly better repair it, at least. And so, for a period there, the testing departments had a bad time. I had a bad time. And now I signalize the recovery from that period and a resurgence into good processing results by actual and very exacting tests, by giving you the basic material which must exist in level one. It becomes obvious that if this material must exist in level one, then level one itself of the six levels of processing becomes tied, lashed, and nailed. And therefore, the amount of flux and change that can be expected in that level hereafter is rather slight. Certainly, there will be all kinds of significances, changes of significances. We'll find this and that and the other thing. But on level one today, we discover, first and foremost, that it must be a step called the remedy of havingness. And that is all it should be really devoted to. A preclear should be put into a position where he is capable of repairing and remedying havingness. To repair havingness simply to make the preclear notice something or to mock something up and shove it into his body. You can merely ask him, what is there in his environment that he can have? And this will repair his havingness. Remedy of havingness is a wider expansion of the same thing, but it makes him capable of not only pushing it into his body or himself, but also throwing the item away. And a complete remedy of havingness occurs when the preclear is able to freely and easily throw one mock-up away. Now, there are two ways this is done. It's done on the physical universe level on three stages, and it's done on the preclear's universe in three stages. And those three stages are these. To accept on an inflow basis, to let remain where it is, and to throw away or dispose of. The three essential actions of a remedy of havingness. It's very easy to get a graph of that in your mind. It's quite simple to see this. If you simply visualize it as the preclear with baseballs thrown at him, the preclear letting baseballs sit out in front of him without them rolling away or coming toward him, and the preclear being able to throw away baseballs. Those are the three steps. Now, in the physical universe, this is run, interestingly enough, on a very permissive basis. We ask the individual to look around him and discover what there is in his environment that he can have. And he simply spots these things. Now, the funny part of it is that at first, he may not really find things that he can have. He'll sort of guess at it, and to be obliging and agreeable. There's nothing more maddening than an agreeable preclear. These are maddening. He will say, yes, I can have that. But your clue is usually signalized by, there isn't anything here I couldn't have. Da. Unless he's had some awfully good auditing, and unless his test results at the beginning of his intensive was entirely at the top of the favorable band, this would not be true. He is abuttered all over the universe. He has no reality on this whatsoever. All right, but you keep nagging at him in a pleasant sort of way without breaking his communication, and he finally will start to pick up particularities out of this wholeness that he can have, and then he will graduate from there on up on a gradient scale until he can have everything in the environment. But before that occurs, another step is usually undertaken, and that is he appears to be fairly easy. You see, his somatics are off, and he appears to be in pretty good shape. And we change the auditing question, throwing in a good communication bridge. We change the auditing question to, now, what is there around here that you would permit to remain exactly where it is? Now, you understand that is not a parrot auditing command. That is just the sense of that auditing command. There are better ways of saying this. But you want him to find things that he wouldn't care if they stayed there, you see. You understand the essence of it. It's all right if that thing isn't in action, you see. If it isn't coming in or going away or doing something of the sort. And the doggonedest feeling of relief is liable to come over your preclear as you run this. And finally, he will get the bulk of the environment. But it's all right if it stays right where it is. And this is a repair of havingness all by itself. And, of course, you're completing the remedy of havingness on the physical universe by asking the third question. Now, what is there around here, throwing in a nice communication bridge, you go on to the third question, what is there around here that you could dispense with? You wouldn't mind if it just disappeared. And he's liable to do an awful lot of com lagging on that. Now, that, of course, is running on the physical universe. Now, you could do these three things. What could he accept in the room? What could he let remain? And what could he throw away? In another order. But you would find you would be sorry if you did. He would most eagerly answer the third question first. What is there in this room that you wouldn't mind dispensing with? And the preclair, on an inverted havingness, will say, oh, boy, who? Oh. Well, let's see, you, and so here we go, you see. And as he answered this question in this fashion, and this is an interesting thing for a research auditor to do, is just ask that question first. And watch the preclear just sort of wilt away. Preclear so enthused. That's what's so remarkable. He is so enthused as a Thetan as he goes about this action of dispensing with everything. And his enthusiasm goes right straight down to the boil-off. He'll go pitching everything out right to the moment when he practically kicks off. And I swear, if you could audit him during the boil-off, he would probably keep right on throwing everything away. So it's easy to run it in that order first, but not therapeutic. And we are, again, limited in Scientology in that we use Scientology to do things for people, not to them. Slight difference word there, preposition, isn't it? Slight difference, but it makes all the difference in what an auditor's doing. Now, if you really wanted to do something to people, you would just ask. You just ask him casually, what could you get rid of without preparing him at all? And it gives you some sort of an idea of the gradient that you have to work up in these three auditing questions. Gives you some idea of the gradient. In other words, you're going to have to run him pretty high before you can ask that third question. See, it isn't something then that you'd do in 15 minutes. Nor yet something you might do in one session. What I've just laid out is routinely, for most preclears, you will find a couple of session project, if you were just to go at it. Because it is almost endless as a process. Do you know what the end goal of the process is? It is the possession of the entire physical universe, or its rejection, knowing in particular what is in it. Now, that is quite a goal for a process. Well, you must have a process, if it's to have any truth in it at all, which must run in that fashion at level one. It must be able to continue for a very long time. Because if it does not, it is a process which, as is too much preclear.
Now, basically, we don't have very much pre-clear to start with. And there is the rub. If we had an unlimited amount of pre-clear to start with, we could run any amount of limited processes. But we don't have. And as a result, then we need processes which will go a long way. And that one, just on the physical universe, will go a long way. Now, on the other hand, we have this process which is fascinating on the mock-up level. Now, we know mock-ups and so forth. It, again, is a gradient scale process. And the first thing the auditor would ask the pre-clear is, can you get a mental picture out there in front of you? Now, of course, the pre-clear, backed down by centuries, millennia of tradition, has a definite conviction that what he is mocking up has no connection with that wall. That's an imaginary picture. You get into royal arguments with some people on this. That's an imaginary picture. It doesn't have anything to do with that over there. Well, unfortunately, they may be making this as a consideration, but it's a consideration made after the fact that it does have a great deal to do with that wall over there. Mental energy is energy. It has wavelength, it has mass, it has position, it occupies space. And you could even run this sort of a test sometime that might amuse you. You might take some chap who does this rather well, whose mock-ups are fairly massive, and weigh him. Weigh him on a very, very accurate scale, paying very close attention to the amount of clothes he has on, so he'll have exactly those clothes on at the end of the test, and you have him mock up and shove into his body mental energy masses. That's a repair of havingness. You don't remedy his havingness. You repair it only. And you keep this up hour in and hour out, and you stuff him so full that he practically couldn't get another mock up inside without it turning into radioactive fission, you know? And you put him over on the scale with the same clothes on, and his weight has increased. It should be very fascinating to anybody. His weight has actually increased. Now we get him to pitch him away and throw him away and really complete a remedy of his havingness if he has survived this arduous repair of havingness. By the way, too much repair of havingness turns on body motivators. You might know that in passing. You just don't keep on repairing havingness forever, for heaven's sakes. It's all right to chuck in a few mock-ups every now and then to make up for what energy you've as-is out of the pre-clear. But if you kept this up very long as a process, you would drive in the pre-clear's anchor points, and he would become rather paranoid about the whole thing. He'd feel that you were against him. And actually, if you repaired his havingness that long, you would be against him. So you can increase his weight, and you can decrease his weight again. The most notable example of this, and the first case on which this was done, already weighed 200 pounds. His weight went up to 230 pounds in a course of 3 weeks of repairing havingness. No other change in his life habits. 30 pounds worth of mock-ups he shoved in. He was doing it all the time. I found he was doing it obsessively, so I showed him how to do it very, very well and then kept tabs on him. And he pushed his weight right up. He pushed his own mass up. And when we started throwing them away, about the time we started throwing them away, he was already of a weight that was threatening to carry him through the bottom of every upholstered chair he sat in. He was concentrated. He was getting like the companion star of Sirius. Now, here's this interesting fact that a mock-up has mass. A great many people can't get mock-ups, they say. There is no such thing as a person who cannot get a mock-up. He can always get a mock-up of some kind or another. He can get an invisible mock-up or a black mock-up. You ask him to close his eyes, ask him what he's looking at. He will first tell you nothing. You say, come, tell me what you were looking at. And he will eventually look, and he'll eventually tell you he is looking at something. He can mock that up. Remember, he can mock up what he is looking at. It's a little truism there. It doesn't hold 1,000%, but it's one of those things that if you want to know, if you want to start with an extreme case, you find he's looking at blackness or he's looking at rockets, he can always throw in some more blackness or some more rockets. You can get a case to recover from blackness if you want to. Just an old simple process of just making plaster the walls with blackness is one of the most elementary of these processes. But making him mock up blackness and pull it in, mock up blackness and let it remain, mock up blackness and throw it away is a remedy of havingness. We don't care anything about the aesthetic of the picture. We're talking about mass being moved in space when we're talking about remedy of havingness. All right. Some other chap's been a machinist. He's been around machinery all his life. And you say, can you do a mental image figure? Yeah. Well, how's it look? Well, it's awfully thin. You know, they're always just kind of gauzy. Well, that's gone now. You say, well, it wouldn't do any good to use that to repair remedy havingness. Oh, yes, it would. Funny part of it is that 15 minutes of repair of havingness or a couple hours spent on remedy of havingness on mock-ups that thin will bring about a considerable change in the attitude of your preclear. There's only been two or three chaps who have bolted ACCs. There have been a great many auditors through advanced clinical course units that I've taught, and out of all of these, there have only been three, really, that have bolted. And this chap, the first day, came in, sat down, and listened to the instructor there giving them their class assignments, and he got very nervous, and he got upset, and he went through another part of the day, and he got more nervous and upset, and he bolted, and I sort of caught him as he bounced off the front door. I was coming up the front door. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going home. I'm not going to have any more to do with this. Everything is bad. It's horrible. Everything's bad over there. You know, it's all bad. It's all bad. And I said, well, come on down to the office and tell me about it. And I got him down to the office, never intending to let him talk another word because I knew what was wrong with him. His havingness was shot. So I stacked him up over against the wall, and I asked him what he could mock up, and he finally told me that he could mock up a machine. For 15 minutes, I repaired his havingness. At the end of 15 minutes, he suddenly had a direct recall on having been on a British destroyer at the Battle of Jutland, and it was shot straight out from underneath him. He was a seaman, and he had been plummeted into the water, and that was a large loss of havingness, wasn't it? Immediately accompanied by the loss of his body's havingness, too. And this thing popped up, and we slammed in a few destroyers, and they were awfully thin. And the chap finally, I did do a good job. It didn't even level it out, nothing, you know. And finally, the fellow started looking relaxed. He looked rather pleased, and he went back to class. We never heard another thing out of him. Got a letter from him the other day. He's having wonderful success as an auditor somewhere in the Middle West. Now, it gives you an idea there. You needn't be too critical nor too exacting about what is being mocked up or thrown away in order to complete a good remedy of havingness by mock-up. But now, since we have a physical universe remedy of havingness, we must differentiate between that and remedy of havingness by mock-up. To an old auditor, remedy of havingness is simply by mock-up, you understand? There's nothing else but a remedy of havingness by mock-up. But this other one has come along. It was the finding things that could remain there, by the way, that cracked the back of the problem. That made a remedy of havingness possible out in the physical universe. So we'll have to differentiate now, and we'll have to say a remedy of havingness by mock-up. Well, that's terribly clumsy, isn't it? But I'm afraid to hang too much complicated terminology on anybody, and that says exactly what it means. You see, it says it does it by mock-up or it does it by physical universe. Now, a remedy of havingness, just amongst us, is simply a remedy of havingness. It doesn't matter whether you remedy it on the preclear's own universe by mock-up or on the physical universe, the end product is the same. His ability to have or not have, his ability to let something stand there without controlling it, is increased. And that's why we're doing it. The ability to have, the ability to not have, the ability to let things remain without controlling them. And that's why we're doing it. All right. It then is not a problem of quantity. It is a problem of changing one's mind, isn't it? You don't remedy havingness, then, by the pound, ton, quart, gallon, nothing like that, you see. You don't remedy havingness this way. The way you remedy havingness is to remedy his ideas about havingness. And you do it by handling havingness, getting him to handle havingness. Do you understand? So you see there, the goal of it is a qualitative goal, not a quantitative goal. So you could get an auditor who would then repair havingness. The old-time auditor often confused these two things. Repair of havingness was invented to disentangle this confusion. Repair of havingness didn't exist as such. Remedy of havingness existed, and some fellow who was obsessively accepting could very easily then simply have the preclear stuff things into the body, 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 and say that he was remedying havingness. He isn't. He's handling it in quantity then, isn't he? He's not handling it in quality, he's handling it in quantity. You're trying to get him to change his idea about what he can have and what he can't have and get easy on the subject. Now, in an economically starved society such as any of these Western societies at this time, the economic duress is such that havingness becomes a considerable problem with the individual. And he gets very fixed ideas. When you upset a person's havingness ratios too much, you get a consequent inability to concentrate on anything else. So the fellow gets obsessed with havingness and leaves doingness entirely, and beingness gets lost in the shuffle. And you have really a routine 20th century businessman of some sort. He's getting so bogged at the middle of this century and the government slogging him and everybody hitting him around and so forth that he's sitting there on what little he's got left, frantically trying to keep what he has, not trying to do with what he has, you see. Now, that is really the condition here of preclear. He's been slapped around on the subject of havingness to such a degree that he's sitting there gripping it to his bosom. Give an example of this. Preclear walks in with a cold. You say to this preclear, what's the matter with you, but why don't we remedy your havingness? So on. We start in, we remedy his havingness. We can keep this up for quite a while. We'll probably do something for his cold. We probably won't get rid of it. Why? We didn't start in on him as a case. We started in on him as an illness. You get the difference? So we think we're going to patch this guy together. Now, I'll tell you what's back of the cold. You're treating a secondary manifestation. That person within the last few days has been threatened with a serious loss. Now, I'll tell you a much better process to get rid of a cold. Fabulous process. It sounds so idiotic, too. It's a havingness process. You simply ask the fellow, you say, "What haven't you lost lately? Tell me something you haven't lost." And usually what he has lost is so buried and out of sight that it swims with great difficulty to the front of his mind. He finally tells you, "Oh, well, nothing really, except my car was stolen 3 days ago and I did get it back," you know, something like that. What's he done? His havingness is so poor that the second he saw something get lost in the environment, he took his arms, beams, theta-wise, and just grabbed this body. And he didn't care what he brought in with that grab. Get it? He held on to the body harder. And in came what we call a ridge, just an energy mass of some sort or another, of some invisibility. See? Grab the body harder. Now, sometimes the loss is very sudden and unexpected, at which moment they will grab whatever mass there is and whatever body there is right there. They'll grab the whole scene. And boy, you get a facsimile that you couldn't take apart with crowbars. Now, that's the tough facsimile to tackle. You say, "Now, where did you hear about your mother's death?" Why ask? The fellow's probably been sitting in the scene ever since, only he's got it covered up with blackness, you know? So he won't have to look at that particular living room and those people all that time, you know? But he has grabbed onto what he has because he might lose it. And anxiety about havingness then gives us most of our manifestations of facsimiles, energy bank, so forth. Now, coupled with all this is the fact that an individual is a very interesting piece of bric-a-brac. Very interesting piece of bric-a-brac. In fact, there is no what-not shelf of any period, even Victorian times, that begins to resemble what this fellow calls a reactive bank. It's the most wonderful thing what this individual will grasp, will clutch to his bosom, will keep around. What old rusty chains and tin cans he has stuck in his pockets. It's fabulous to behold. What is the use of all this material, we say? The use of it is to reassure him that he is there. Total use. And if he holds on to it real hard, he's real reassured. See that? He doesn't care what he has. We find some millionaire with a Rembrandt in his, 180-foot living room with a swimming pool in the middle of it. And here's this Rembrandt, and it's up there, and he comes over and he shows his guests, well, this is Rembrandt. I bought it. It cost me $118,000 and so forth. And there he'll always tell you the price, by the way. And there is this $118,000 Rembrandt, and I got it at vast expense. He's holding on to it. I can tell you, if a fella had to have that much to be reassured that he was there, he doesn't even know that's a Rembrandt. He doesn't even know it's occupying the wall. His havingness, what he can really have in terms of the environment, would probably run this way. All right, look around here, you'd say as an auditor, and tell me what you could have. And he would search and search and search, and he'd finally find a dust mote kicked back underneath the couch, and with some relief he would discover he could have that dust mote. You get the imbalance then. The more a person apparently has the symptom is the less he can have. Now, that's not a tried and true rule, but that's just something that you should look for. The more he apparently has to have, the less he can have. And you find somebody grabbing on to all kinds of chronic somatics, don't think that this is very significant. It's just that the individual has to have more in order to have something, and he can't really have any of it. And that's the story with the preclear, so that, therefore, is level one. There's another great oddity that occupies all of this, and an enormous vista of data at which we have to look to understand this business about remedy of havingness. And let's go at once now into a piece of theory. And this is theory, which an auditor would probably fare very badly without. And this material I'm giving you now is not lead pipe cinch. This is it, hurrah material, you understand. But this is a probability. It has to do with a certain piece of havingness called a body, and this you find your preclear in association with. And what is theoretical about this is only this. Does the body have life of its own, or does it not? And the theoretical conclusion is it does not. The theoretical conclusion is that the body at no time during any part of its genetic line has possessed as its own life. It has never natively, inherently been alive from the moment of conception to birth to death. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But I tell you, that's theoretical. There is no such thing, really, as a living entity which occupies the body and snarls and gnashes its teeth. There is evidently a livingness which can persist for short times in the body on a mock-up basis. Just as you can put up a mock-up and it will last out there for a minute or two and look very alive and animated until you take your attention off of it, so does life persist and continue to motivate and occupy the body. The genetic line is a line which came without too much assistance from ourselves as thetans. And what I'm telling you is theoretical only to this degree, that evidently biology and bacteriology were invented by people who could animate what they looked at through microscopes. There is something wrong. But we know there is something wrong in biology and bacteriology, since these things cannot agree science to science. The basic science of all these things is called cytology, and the tenets of cytology violate the theories and tenets of biology. And yet biology proceeded from cytology. And you get a cytologist, and he argues with the biologist, but they're both basically agreed, but they can't agree on anything. Confusion of this character usually results from the non-existence of something. There's something wrong in their basic theory, or this sort of confusion wouldn't exist. Now, chemistry, biology, and all of these things are very interesting and very factual subjects. There's no doubt about this. But to conceive that a cell is alive, independently of all other life forms, without any more proof than we have, even though we can look through a microscope and see them doing odd things, doesn't hold when we start processing a preclear. Now, here's an oddity. We're taking a much higher look at the sciences today than have been taken at the sciences. This we must be aware of. We're not just a Johnny-come-lately science that is trying to muscle in on some of the more vested interests. This is not the case. We actually are very well instructed in past sciences, and we know where their frailties are and where their uses are. And we're trying to push through darkness that they have never illuminated. Thus, if processing does not demonstrate to us the tenability of a separate livingness called the body, then we should be prepared to abandon that if it doesn't lead us anywhere in the improvement of man. This is not conclusively demonstrated. It's not conclusively proven. It just seems to be the case. Now, I want to tell you what apparently is there. There is a body that is traveling along a certain time track through a certain series of evolutions. And this body consists of a series of postulates laid into it by exterior beings. And this body is enlivened, invigorated, and carried forward by life units. And this is not theoretical, a thetan. That's factual. The thetan evidently puts all the life that is put into this body, and he leaves in this body his designs, desires, mock-ups, postulates in its ridges. And then he shoves off and goes somewhere else, and another thetan comes along at the next evolution of the body and picks it up and carries it along. It's just as though we were running a relay race the way they run it with torches. And as long as the runner has the torch in his hand and doesn't let it fall into the dust, the torch burns. The moment the runner lets go of the torch, it goes out. This is the sort of a race that we seem to be running. Now, in order to accomplish his end, so he won't have to have his attention all the time on the body, he evidently mocks up something, and this thing we call a GE. It is really another body which is inside the body. Now, this is not theoretical, again. This is hard fact. The mystic knew of this thing. The spiritualist knew of this thing. He calls it an astral body. He thinks that when he exteriorizes, he's expected to go out of the body in this other darn thing, you know? It's quite amazing, but that isn't the way it's supposed to add up. Actually, what seems to be the case there is that in order to get a gradient scale from his own postulating to the body, he mocks up what is in reality a series of masses, each one of which is interactive with the next mass, and then is therefore able to move such a thing as an ashtray. And the composite of these connecting units we could call the genetic entity. And this apparently has life. It has mass, it moves, and it seems to have some control over thee. Anytime that you move out of a body in a genetic entity, you will, if you ever have done this, or if you've had a preclear who has done this — this is rather easy to do, by the way — the person is a spiritualist, he'll think he's exteriorized. He hasn't exteriorized, he's got a suit on. And he'll stick to the walls, he'll stick to chairs, he'll do all sorts of weird things. But what he's got there is a bunch of structure. And this structure sticks inside of this other mass called the body and animates it. And when that structure pulls out, the body evidently has no further life in it, but will keep on running automatically for a very short period of time, probably about 8 minutes. So a thetan could go out of a body and also out of the GE, you see. See, he could go out of both of these, leave the GE there, and the body keep on running for a lot longer than 8 minutes. But the second he takes what he mocks up and that he is endowing with life, and which is then endowing the body with life, when he takes that out too, there is no further life endowed in the body. Now, that's the theory. You see this? Now, what's terribly factual here, what's gruesomely factual, is the existence of a thetan. Man's been talking about this beast for a long time. In fact, he's practically never consistently talked about anything else. He's changed his mind about everything else except that man has some concourse with the spirit. There's something to do with the spirit here someplace. And even the commie today with his dialectic materialism, let's all be beasts. That's the national anthem, isn't it? I mean, he has himself a fine time of it there, of admitting the existence of a spirit. Because he fights so hard to convince everybody there isn't one. And this is a sort of a negative confirmation. But it's interesting why he has to fight that hard. It's because his native land is so thoroughly sold on the existence of a spirit that every significant revolution it has had has come off in the main because of some spiritual hocus-pocus. Tsar dies, some peasant out in Grotchek or something of the sort suddenly says, "I am the Tsar." And all the peasants in the neighborhood suddenly get out their pitchforks and say, "Three cheers, here is the rightful Tsar," and they go marching on Spuffengrad or something and chop everybody down. It's enough to have a famous personage die in Russia to have revolts incipient all over the place and everybody putting them down, because all of a sudden people declare that they are now this person, they are now that sort of thing. And they're quite daffy in this direction. I may be I'm giving it a very superficial look, but they're worried. That's why they keep Lenin in Red Square in plain sight. They wouldn't dare do otherwise. There he sits. If you wanted to destroy the government of Russia, all you would have to do is hook that body. And they'd have had it right then. People all over the place would say, "I am Lenin." And away we go. Now, the fact is then that the most ungodly nation on earth seems to be obsessed with the idea of the spirit. Still continues us in line of the fact that man has been talking about this thing for a long time. And it hasn't been until recent times that within the last 4 years with Scientology, that a good, solid grip was had on this subject. And Scientology might be the panacea for a lot of things. It might be able to do this, it might be able to do that, and it might be good for this and good for that, and so on. But the actual, and I tell you this as professional students of Scientology, I wouldn't tell the public this, because they'd shudder in their boots, they'd throw it overboard, they'd turn their backs and walk the other way. But the significant contribution of Scientology is the elucidation of this basic problem of what is a man. It demonstrates conclusively the existence of the spirit, the body, and the interconnection. And this problem has been buried in so many ages of squabble. There have been so many wars fought over it. There have been so many spirits separated from bodies in an effort to prove that there were no spirits that one rather loses count. and so it's a rather touchy subject. But the truth of the matter is that a thetan does exist. The proper definition of a thetan, it really is. He has no space, no mass, no wavelength, and he is capable, however, of the production of these things, and he is capable of postulates, and he can make time, and he can make everything else. And he does so in agreement. And this is open and shut. This is one of these things that we got nailed. This is taped. If you tried to process somebody today without this reality, you would have an interesting time of it, to say the least, because you'd run one of these processes well over a period of time, and all of a sudden the fellow would say, my body is right there in front of me. What am I doing up here on the wall? I'm scared. And you would say, well, I guess this fellow, like psychiatry, you know, has always said that a person was crazy if he was exteriorized. That's a nice way to defeat the whole thing, too. Person's kind of crazy if he isn't. But anyhow, merely because he's in too close approximation to the body. Anyhow, that one, that's taped. But what is the exact relationship between the thetan and the body? Number one, the thetan wants to have a game. He definitely desires a game. Well, in order to have a game, he has to limit his liberty. A game is a thing of restriction. It's agreed upon restrictions. And in order to have concourse with his fellows, in order to have friendship and companionship and fun and things like this, he has to be in association with his fellows. Now, in order to have a game, he has to have a certain amount of freedom. And he has to have a certain amount of say as to how the game is going. You see these two things arguing against each other. There's the two more fundamental things, or not more fundamental, but less fundamental, that argue against each other, is the idea of wanting to communicate so one is free to communicate and needing barriers or restrictions in order to accomplish communication. See, this is another less fundamental step. But the thetan wants a game. That's about the highest consideration there is. And so, wanting a game, he has to have the restrictions of the game. He gets the restrictions of the game. If he gets too many, then he doesn't have a game. So there are two ways a thetan can't have a game. To be too free, to be too enslaved. To have his attention too dispersed, or his attention too fixed. An individual who has a bad stomach is not having a game. His attention is not on the game, it's on his stomach. A person who does not have any stomach at all is not having a game because he never has a stomach to put his attention on. You get the idea. So there is a happy medium, fortunately, and as in photographic film, there is the matter of latitude. One individual has a wider latitude for happiness than another. Some individual, you dump him in a ditch or in a palace and he'd be a happy man. His blood brother, you might say, has to be walked exactly, dressed exactly, with the exact briefcase and the exact umbrella, and it must be all exactly lint-free, and the hours of the day must go off exactly right for this fellow to feel that he might possibly at some time or another find a little relaxation. You get the idea. Now, this is just breadth of what one considers the game. But in Scientology, you can do two things. Never forget that you can do these two things. Otherwise, you'll get stuck. You can give them ultimate freedom. I mean, just swish. What universe? I mean, you could do this today. Or, on the other side, you could give them never heard of freedom. Look at all these lovely restrictions. Total, solid restrictions on all hands. These two extremes are possible in the knowledge of Scientology, but Scientology is used to establish a more optimum game. Not a more optimum freedom, not a more optimum restriction, but a more optimum game. You got the idea? All right. Now, the second you do that, with a pre-clear, you will have a successful case. The second you merely make him free, you might have a very unsuccessful case. The time when you really get him nailed down into the barriers, he's liable to again be a very unsuccessful case. Do you get the idea? He has some idea of his own latitudes, and you assist him to assume them. And knowing what you know, and knowing what he could know, you can lead him forward to the assumption of a better latitude of freedom, a better latitude of restriction. An individual who cannot control himself is no use on your team, believe me. And yet, what is non-control but total non-restriction? So you see how that could be defined. It could be defined in several ways, and it would all come out to the same thing, though, that individuals can be too free, and individuals can be too enslaved. And the ultimate result that you will attain as an auditor lies somewhere between the two. And that somewhereness includes the power of choice of the individual. Quite an important factor. In fact, you could ride practically the whole way just on this one thing, power of choice. And winds up eventually in pan-determinism, all the things that you know about that. The individual can be both people in the conversation. He's a good conversationalist. I mean, that's all. If he can only be one, If under no circumstances could he be other than one, he's not a conversationalist. He's the wallflower of the party. All right. Now, all the various conditions come out of these things. So, what are we trying to do with this havingness? All right, let's take this GE simply as a provided mass. There he is. That is meant to control a thing called a body, which is coming along the line as an animate mock-up. Not a live mock-up, get the difference. It's an animate mock-up. Of what intricacy it is wonderful to behold. It's the most fabulous thing you ever saw in your life. I mean, it has all kinds of things. It has heartbeats and kidneys and reflexes and tibias and wow. And you get out into electronic structure and you'll find out that it, one little anchor point snapped out of place may keep a joint from bending properly. And you'll find out that if you were really good at bending anchor points, you could get the body bones to bend anywhere. I mean, we can do some odd things in Scientology. You can actually move the anchor point of the wrist up to the middle of the forearm and bend the arm at the middle of the forearm. Fabulous, but nevertheless, it's factual. Now, the arrangement of the electronic anchor points seems to be the governing factor. No, it's not the governing factor. There's no life in these anchor points. These aren't trapped thetans. They're just mock-ups. But the Thetan has mocked up some sort of a body that he then uses to monitor these anchor points. You got it? An electronic relay system. So when he moves this body, it's incorrect to call it a GE. The GE is really the body coming up the line. But he moves this electronic mass that he controls, and the other mass then moves. And when he gets these two things out of balance, so that when he moves his electronic mass, the other mass doesn't move properly, he starts going into apathy, starts going out of control, and he only knows one thing, that he's losing. The ultimate of this circumstance is death. It doesn't matter how much he moves his mocked-up masses, no matter how much he changes his mind or makes his postulates, there's no further wiggle on the part of the body. He says, well, that's the end of that game. And by the way, 10 feet away from the body and gone, he couldn't have cared less. But up to that point, he cares dreadfully. You see? Well, what is a body? Where did it come from? That's beyond our scope where it came from. But it could merely evolve as a composite of the consecutive ideas of Thetans getting together and playing a game. See, it could. Now, here's an oddity. We have never had a successful Thetan duplication. Operating Thetan mocks up another Thetan to be him. Some of the operating Thetans that have done this are pretty good, too. Knock off rooftops. Other little oddities, parlor tricks we call them. Now, an individual then mocks himself up as another being with life in it. And that other being lives. for tickety, 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 thuth. It has finite mortality. It has mortality. It goes just so far and goes out. In other words, he can't go off leaving himself successfully. Theoretically, he could do this. He could always duplicate himself. But in actual practice, he mocks himself up to keep running the pushcart, and he'll only run the pushcart for a certain length of time before all of a sudden we no longer have an animate being running the pushcart. Get the idea? Something happens there. He does not mock up another thetan then, which blows to pieces the idea of a supernatural creator of this universe. If a thetan as powerful as some operating thetans of my cognizance cannot mock up another thetan to perform within certain limits over a long period of time, I don't think it can be done. I don't say it can't. I wouldn't put that restriction on you for a moment. But an individual is an individual. A guy is a guy. A thetan is a thetan. He is alive. He is himself. He wasn't made by anybody. You can get that idea. Why, you got it. He is not part of Joe, and Bill is not part of Pete. Bill is Bill, and Joe is Joe. And although they call themselves Bill and Joe when they get here, they back 40 feet off, and they might call themselves, to amuse themselves, the Red Terror or the Peanut Vendor. It doesn't matter what they call themselves. They will no longer think of themselves as Joe. So they get the idea they're separate beings, because they change their mind and become separate beings, the behavior of a thing. But what effectually do you do in processing? You handle the deposited masses of the ages, which are traveling along on a certain postulated cycle. And by getting the individual to rearrange these masses, you get a better body, a more controllable body, you get greater freedom for the thetan, and you get better livingness. The postulates, the havingnesses, which have been deposited in this line, are evidently the line itself. A thetan does this astonishing thing. He thinks matter out of existence, rubbing thoughts on a piece of energy, can cause it to disappear. And the simple thinkingness inside a body can cause mass to vanish. So processing comes down to this interesting thing. It is thinkingness to knock out the undesirable things and havingness to place in their place the requisite mass to reassure the thetan that he is there, plus the ability of the thetan to adequately change his mind and assume capabilities which he natively has in order to play a better game. And there you have about the size of it. You use his thinkingness to rub out what's bad by granting life to the things he has always restrained life from. You get that? He's restrained life from these masses, therefore they have gone on being masses. So you get him to give those masses. He does not want life in terms of erasure. They vanish. And then you have to supplant the mass that you have erased. And so processing is a jockeying between knocking the mass out and putting more desirable mass in, to the end product of changing the thetan's mind about mass, space, energy, and himself. And that is processing. Therefore, we have level one concentrating on what is the realest thing to your thetan as you process him. There he sits, running that pre-clear body, and you're going to show him that there is mass. And he gets happy about that. He's reassured and he is there. And then he gets willing to change his mind. He gets willing to do, be, have, and all the rest of these things. But the entering wedge is to reassure him with some mass. So there is no slightest doubt that that will be level one for an awful long time to come. Thank you.